we're going to talk today about the state of professional services, and I want to sort of define that. You know, when we did the study, we didn't look at all services. We looked specifically at project-based services. So they're the things that have, a firm start date and end date. You know, they're around a deployment. They're around a consulting project. They may be fixed fee. They may be billable, but they're not body shop type work. So it's true consulting and deployment. So that's what we wanted to focus on in this study. We had about 177 participants to the online survey. The participants, roughly average about 2.1 million in projected annual revenue for this coming year. And they broke out kind of standard in terms of mix. About 66% were small and regional partners, about 28% were medium-sized, and about 6% are large nationals. And the sort of the range of the markets that they were covering was typical as well, with the smaller folks focused on mid-market and small, the medium folks kind of a mix with some enterprise, and the larger ones focusing mostly on the enterprise. And in terms of business models, these guys identified themselves mostly as consultants, which was sort of typical and understandable as well. And, we'll get into a little bit more about business model in a second. When you dive kind of into the data, one thing you might have noted from the previous slide is that in this online survey, there were 177 respondents. That's lower than typically you'll see for projects that we do. There was a very specific reason. We set a threshold of a minimum of 30% of revenue from project-based services to participate in the study. Early on in the study, I actually got a call from the data folks, and they said, hey, Jeff, the response rate is a little low. Do we want to dive into this? Do we want to do something? And we dove in. What we saw is that there was a precipitous drop-off in participation between folks who could achieve the 20% of their revenue in project-based services to the folks who had 30% of the revenue in project-based services. So there seemed to be a big numerical chasm there around ability, skill set, desire to grow that, and it really separated folks from people who just had complementary services businesses to folks who really wanted to focus on it. It was a 50% drop-off. So, had we lowered that criteria, we could have gotten nearly twice as many participants, but we didn't want to lower the criteria because we really wanted to talk to the folks who were focused on this business. The other thing we looked at in the data was, who of the respondents qualified as strategic service providers as defined by IPED? And I think you guys are familiar with that, that definition. I can go over that at the end if you like. Only about 10% qualified as strategic service providers, which surprised us. But, then we thought about it a little more, realizing that our criteria of strategic service provider meant that recurring revenue services were greater than project-based services. When we sort of did a control and said, okay, what if we gave these guys a pass and said, well, the project-based services could meet your 30% minimum. You didn't have to do a lot of recurring revenue services. All of a sudden, 50% fell into that SSP category based on the other three criteria. So what we found is that these folks who were services-led in their strategy, even if they didn't qualify as our definition of SSP, they looked and acted a lot like those SSPs, particularly when it comes to, where they engaged, with line of business management and selling business solutions, which we'll talk about a little in a second. And just on the right-hand side, just you give sort of anecdotally, as a whole, the base that we talked to, garnered about 54% of their overall revenue in project-based professional services. So these were really services-heavy folks. We also asked them, a little bit about their offerings and the margins they were making on the offerings. So in terms of pre-sales, consulting, and services offerings, solution design was the top delivered pre-sales offering and the most profitable, and that was really no surprise, often offered by VARs, value-added resellers. What was interesting, though, is that financial cost analysis was in the top three most offered, but it was the least profitable. And performance and capacity analysis was the least offered, but it was the second most profitable. So we kind of dove in the interviews to see, what this inconsistency was about. And more or less what we found was these were skills issues. People are tough to find. Partners, all things being equal, would rather offer some of these, you know, perceived higher value pre-sale services, but they just can't find the folks. So if you can't find the right folks, you're either not able to charge the proper margins on the service, or you just can't offer the service at all. Solution design is something that a standard competency of a solution architect can deliver an engagement like that. It takes a little more of an advanced skill set to deliver things like financial cost analysis, performance analysis, and things like that. From a post-sale services side, again, not a ton of surprise here. Integration with existing technology was the number one offered service. Application development, on the other hand, was the most profitable offered post-sale services, and you can see the margins there. The other trend that we saw across both of these, both pre-sales and post-sale services, was that folks who identified in an SI business model tended to garner the highest margin in each of these categories, with consultants being second and VARs generally being third. That it could be for a variety of reasons. It could be from the perceived skill set advantages on behalf of the end user that those groups had, or it could just be that those types of, people self-identifying in those categories tend to be better and more adept at selling services, so they could just be holding their price better and getting better margins. But we thought that was at least interesting to know. Since we do have a small group and all the lines are open, I want to just take a quick pause and see if there's any questions, comments, or thoughts on anything we've presented so far. No? All right. So from a data standpoint, looking at the data, and we'll get into more of this later, but there are really four key big takeaways from the study for us. The first was that talent management is really the driving issue for service-focused partners. When people are the product, finding the right people, training the right people, retaining the right people is everything. We know that professional services-led business are difficult to scale because it's a people business. If you can't find the people, you can't perform the services. So talent management, across the board in a variety of forms, was the number one thing that they struggled with, whether it was, recruiting, training, retaining, et cetera. The other thing we sort of called out was this idea of the influencer's dilemma, plaguing their relationships with partners. So big services projects demand a lot of resources up front in the sales cycle. Partners are brought in. Executives are brought in. Senior delivery folks are brought in to wow the customer, maybe work on the reference architecture or the solution design. They're very heavy up front. That means gaps in future business. While a good chunk of your talented people are chasing one big deal, well, what aren't they doing? They're not chasing other big deals. This often bleeds into the delivery of the service as well, which was interesting in your guys' perspective on. So what ends up happening is oftentimes these big deals they chase, they become high probability wins because they do a great job of going after them, but their ability to get new business lags. For you as vendors, this means that oftentimes on your dashboards, you see very, very lumpy quota revenue attainment on the product side from these guys, which ends up being a negative impact. And we'll get into why it may be not the best idea to look only at that when considering these partners, because they bring a lot of value to the table for vendors in terms of delivery capacity and influence that isn't necessarily always reflected in their lower volume of product sales. The other thing we noticed was project-based PS and MSP businesses do not scale together well except for the largest partners with lots of resources. The businesses have different selling motions, different investment profiles, different cost structures. It takes a lot to pull off running these successful businesses together. This puts some of these particularly smaller services partners at a disadvantage, that they haven't been able to see some of the benefits of they haven't been able to achieve some of the benefits of recurring revenue businesses because of their size. It's difficult to build those businesses side by side and run them both, so they default to what they know, what they've been doing, which is traditional project-based services. And the last idea is the big get bigger. And this is sort of a roll up in a combination of some of the other points that we already talked about. Programmatically, and from a market dynamic standpoint, some of these smaller PS providers, they're just simply at a disadvantage in vendor programs that reward product sales over building skills and capacity. And with the inability to scale and level out those businesses with recurring revenue, it's difficult to them to crack to the top. So what ends up happening is the folks who focus less on services and really just moving product, who, by the way, may or may not be actually influencing the sale of your product. They could just be taking orders. They're naturally going to get bigger. They're naturally going to get the more of the benefits from your partner program, potentially at the expense of these guys. And again, we'll talk a little later about why we think that's a risk in the marketplace for vendors. So this first thing, talent management, I just want to pick out a couple data points. We're not going to go over all of these. Universally, finding qualified talent was noted as the number one challenge. This was resounding. There's a shortage of talent, and part and parcel to that, number two, the top partner request was to reduce the training costs and certification. 55% ranked as number one. Where they can't find the right talent, they have to train the right talent. And a lot of partners said that, you know, the cost of training has become a huge drain on their profit. I'm just curious, you know, any thoughts on this from you guys? Is this, are you hearing this from partners? Oh, come on.
So I'll make a quick comment on that. A lot of things that I hear, it's not necessarily as much of the outlay cost, but the time away of not being built.
Yeah, so that is a big thing. So, you know, partners were really split on training, and I believe the next slide is around training. Well, you know what, I'm just going to jump to that. Yeah, I'll jump back to that previous slide. So on your point, partners are really split on training, right? So I think everyone recognizes the value of training, but the costs are big. But in the interviews, we heard everything from, what you just said, that the real costs and the opportunity costs are very difficult, but also that, online training, doesn't offer much. What has emerged, though, is a trend and a desire towards mentoring. Many feel like the idea of mentoring and a hands-on approach where you send consultants out with partners, perhaps even as part of, initial certification on a new product where they can't get certified on the product unless one of your folks shadows them on a deployment, sort of signs off and says, okay, these guys are good at this, rather than sending them to a class, have the hands-on knowledge transfer out in the field. There were a lot of comments. A Cisco program was brought up around a new telephony system, and some storage vendors who are really doing some good work here were noted by partners. I'm curious. I didn't notice the name of who made that comment. Have you gotten that feedback from partners, or have you seen that in your own business? This idea of how do we integrate mentoring into bringing the skill set of delivery people up in the field for partners?
Yeah, sorry, it's Greg from Hitachi Ventura.
Oh,
so we do have a shadowing program, and it is something that is useful, but also complicated because you now have your billable resources tied up shadowing somebody else's billable resources. And then if there's multiple offices involved, does that shadowing allow you to extend the certification across their offices, or do you have to have more of a train-the-trainer? So I'm more curious on the train-the-trainer because I think that's maybe how you can scale it a bit faster is if we can have their own people shadow themselves once we've done the first shadowing.
Yeah, and I think, I can tell you from personal experience, I probably should have credentialized a little bit more at the beginning, but I spent about 20 years in the channel, mostly in the services space. I worked for EMC Consulting. I worked for a firm called Glasshouse Technologies and built a PS organization for a software firm. And, yeah, train the trainer, it has to be the way things are done. I can tell you that, by and large, for those people who have whose services businesses are significant parts, you know, of their business, services revenue. That is what they do internally. Particularly because of labor shortages, they simply oftentimes can't bring in folks with the ready-made skills. Their only alternative is to pair people up. I didn't talk to any partner specifically in my interviews around the train-the-trainer model, but I know it's prevalent, and I would be certain that, you know, any partner who you went with a value proposition to say, hey, listen, I'm going to invest in this resource. I'm going to put a person on site with you for a day or 2 days or 3 days, or we're going to shadow you on an engagement, but you've got to commit to having at least two of your people in the room, right? Even if they're not doing work at the customer site, to make sure that, you know, the knowledge can get transferred on to more than just one person, and you can be in a position to pass it forward. I'd say that's generally a great thought, I think a fair ask to the partner to say, I'll do this, but you've got to commit to mastery and then training your own folks. And you know, people would be open to that because it does, you know, in the long run, it does lower their costs, right? As long as the certification can still be attained, programmatically for you guys, it can really help defer costs for them for not having that resource.
This is Alex from Red Hat. One of the things that we found in the train-the-trainer situation is with funded heads. So we train the funded head, and then part of their MBOs or KPIs is to train, whether they're a sales trainee or if it's a technical funded head, to train the technical resources.
Sure.
Become valuable for us.
That I would think would have a ton of value for some of your larger partners. Right, where there are, you know, funded heads, the value probably lessens at the lower range, but I would think that that's a very successful approach.
So quick question on that: when you go down a path like that, which I think is a good path, is but you still force a Prometric type certification exam to validate, or is the activity enough?
I think, you know, I don't know that I have a strong opinion on that. I think that you would have to form your own philosophy on that for a variety of reasons. You know, complexity of technology. You know, the time it takes to invest in the training. What I can tell you is that so let's separate being trained and being certified, right? And this is something I don't think I ever created a slide on it, but it's something that I experienced in my world and spoke to partners about in this study, is that end users do not care about certifications. Solution providers are almost never asked, are you certified in XYZ before a consultant comes on site to do work? Now, I'm willing to say that could be very different in some product sets, and even in some industries and some segments. I don't want to make that exclusive statement, but I can't think of a single example in my 20 years in the business of selling PS and project managing large projects where an end user actually asked for the certification. So the test, honestly, it's irrelevant to the end user. It's largely irrelevant to the solution provider. It's important to you. So if you feel it is important, if you feel if it's the best and only way to validate that skill set, then by all means use it. But understand that you have the flexibility to make that decision because you as the vendor are the folks who are valuing that certification above any other constituency in the marketplace. I hope that wasn't too much of a rambling answer.
Makes sense.
So, talent acquisition, we talked about this a little. 71% said finding talent is their biggest challenge. 36% said that then competing with vendors and end users financially for that talent was their second biggest challenge, but, you know, to obviously a less extent. And, this is very real. People move around in this business a lot. They move from partner to vendor to end user. For better or for worse, the partner is often in the position of being able to pay the least, of all of those constituencies, and also tends to be in the position to provide the least quality of life too, in terms of potential travel and being on site for long hours and stress and pressure and things like that. So that's a real issue. You know, one thing we say is please don't poach from your partners. It's tough enough for them to compete in the world anyway. But that's something that should be held sacrosanct. It was an interesting stat. So only 17, we asked people what the biggest challenge was. Only 17% said the biggest challenge was cost of training and certification. Yet when we asked, in a different way, what's your biggest vendor ask? What do you need from vendors? They said reduce the cost of training and certification overwhelmingly. What I found in the interviews is that things like talent acquisition, recruiting, finding people, areas like that, it just wasn't a place where the solution providers even thought that you could help, that you being vendors, right? So it didn't even occur to them that you would have a role to play there, which is why no very few people actually mentioned help me with recruiting, as their number one or even number two or three, but they knew that something that the vendor controlled was the cost of training, which is why it was the number one ask, though it appeared low on the scale of challenges. So shifting from talent to this influencer's dilemma. We believe and we see that the data proves out that, these services-led partners, they're highly influential within the sales cycle. They're talking largely to business leaders. In fact, partners said on average 30% of their engagements fall into the all business solutions. I'll explain to you what that means in a second. So they have a high level of influence at the executive level. 65% of proposals that these guys are delivering contain project-based services, so it's a high service content. And what they're seeing is that proposals that include services generally have a 16% higher close rate than proposals without services. They're also spending, almost 62% of their engagement time ahead of the sale, effectively. So if we look at, I'm going to jump through to a slide here. The influencer's dilemma. So if you think about, the fact that these service providers, they're heavily engaged up front. When we ask them, when do you get engaged? 62% of their time, they're getting their engagement either before the need is defined, or at requirements definition, or during the solution design. So they're in the right place at the right time to wield influence over the product decision when they can. But again, that ability to highly influence the sale comes as a price because they're over-resourcing, especially their large services deals. So while they're over target with a high probability of winning a deal, they're not selling elsewhere. And I sort of alluded to this, but I want to sort of carry this out. What ends up happening is these guys have great quarters where they sell tons of their services and they sell lots of your product, and then they immediately have a bad quarter because all their effort was spent on a deal or a few deals in one quarter. Some of those resources actually bled into project kickoff. I'm sure you've heard from partners, the challenges they have is, the senior architect who did all the pre-sales work and design, well, that customer is not willing to let that person go, right? We want that person to go on to another project, help with pre-sales, do a lot of other things. The customer puts the foot down, no way, I trust that person. They got to be involved in the project. We had partners tell us that this dynamic actually hurts them programmatically within your programs. And actually had some partners say flat out, we had some great quarters, and then we lost our CAM coverage the next quarter. And two quarters later, we were downgraded in the program because we were delivering on this massive services deal around this vendor's product, making them incredibly happy, And we didn't have time to sell the other stuff. Now, that's part and parcel of the reseller business. It's part and parcel of the consulting business, the scalability of the consulting business, the lumpiness of it. But, you know, it's also important to understand that if these partners are at a disadvantage because they're operating in a model which actually makes them more highly influential than your other partners to influence a sale and puts them in a better position to make your customer happy, but they're getting negatively impacted programmatically because they're not selling enough product, that could end up having some risks to capacity for you down the line, right? So it's a risk for you both to have too few partners selling your product in the marketplace, but it's also a risk for you to have too few partners servicing your product in the marketplace. So to the extent that they're getting pushed out of the advantages of some of your program because they're not hitting the product volumes, eventually they're going to favor investing in other skill sets, meaning invest in skill sets around other vendors. And ultimately, you know, that could be a revenue impact for vendors who are not mindful of that. We talked about this a little. I just sort of alluded to it. This is kind of one of the criteria of the SSP model. So we track how partners sell into their clients and ask them to characterize, are you selling mostly, you know, fulfillment, you know, a predefined need with an IT solution? Are you selling an all IT solution, meaning you're selling to a CIO, you're selling to a VC technology, and it's largely kind of an infrastructure play? Are you selling business solutions to IT decision makers, or are you selling business solutions to line of business decision makers? And for these services heavy, services led partners, we found that they spend more of their time than the average solution provider population, 30% of their time selling what we consider business solutions to line of business managers. That green arrow you see there, you know, is showing that in the census data and the broader solution provider population, only about 25% of the engagement is there. For these services-led partners, 30% of their engagement is in that space. Just anecdotally, for strategic service providers, you know, as we've defined them, their engagement in that area is 38%. You know, so they're somewhere in between the general solution provider population and moving towards strategic service providers. And again, we think that here the relevancy to the conversation we're having now is that they wield a tremendous amount of influence at the upper echelons of the businesses that they're calling on. So running the business. So when you think about services-led business, when you think about consultants, intellectual property is critical for both proper profit and competitiveness. We'll talk a little bit in a second about, you know, what we look at intellectual property. But we heard time and time again that scripts, documentations, tool sets were not shared as freely as they would like from their vendor partners. And these have both, you know, competitiveness impact and profit impact for the services led partner. Another, you know, business infrastructure sort of thing that we uncovered and I alluded to earlier is that, you know, consultants and SIs in particular cite only 5% of their revenue coming from recurring revenue services. It puts them in a tough position. It puts them in a tough position specifically since our census data shows that the MSP business, you know, obviously anchored by recurring revenue, is the largest growing business model, you know, in terms of what resellers or what solution providers are focusing on, you know, in 2018 and beyond. So these guys, again, because of that tough position where it's very expensive to have a very successful people-based project-based business and an MSP business side by side, they're getting a little left out. And you know, again, that presents a downstream risk to this population, which delivers a really important aspect of delivery capacity for all of you folks. Will they slowly get squeezed out of the market if we can't help them be a little more successful at adding some recurring revenue to the revenue stream? If you look at services-led partners, specifically consultants, SI. This is a model that I think you've seen before. If you guys attended any of the profitability webinars that we did last fall, I did one of them. We talked about this model in a little more detail. This just shows you the profitability levers for these folks focused on services, you know, where things that you can do to increase profit or decrease costs, which ultimately increases profit. Just, you know, in terms of revenue driving, you know, competitive win rates, we saw with these partners, you know, again, just to be a little redundant, that 16%, that proposals with services attached won 16% more often. If you move kind of down to the solutions development block and think about repeatable solutions and reference architectures, this IP sharing is really what drives it, right? To the extent that you can share those reference architectures and those package solutions with solution providers, they can make the solutions and services more repeatable. That gives them a greater degree of profit. You can make the reference architectures more solid, and oftentimes they use those as selling tools. So IP really matters there. Another place that IP matters is decreasing costs, whether it be SG&A and COGS, whether it's scripts, whether it's deployment tools, things like that. You can help partners lower costs. And then lastly, you know, tracking KPIs and knowing the business helps people reduce their costs. You know, partners know that they need to track their KPIs, and the number one KPI they were trying to track is utilization. But services automation makes a big difference there. Many of these partners do not have sophisticated services automation. It's difficult for them to track those KPIs, and they know with some certainty that they need to get better at that. I mentioned all of this, but I'll just cover this briefly. The top three investments in intellectual property for these providers: number one was scripts and tools for deployment, number two was on-site documentation, and number three was delivery methodologies. I want to just touch on delivery methodologies just quickly. So this is one area that you could potentially look at as a way to judge the maturity of a professional services provider. To the extent that they've developed both runbooks for operations and deployment, but also descriptions and processes of how they're going to get a customer from A to B. You know, it may be XYZ Partners' four-step process, you know, for deploying bring your own device program or a new mobility program, where you see artifacts, proof points of them selling into a methodology. That's a real sign of maturity, and again, in my personal experience, it definitely is meaningful in terms of the success rate that those services-led partners have in terms of being in front of customers and being able to prove and get to the next level and build that trust of being able to deploy for them. So kind of lastly, we're starting to wrap up, some takeaways in vendor programs and engagements. So understand that, when we ask these partners, you know, services-led partners, why do you choose one vendor or another? Well, the number one reason was, in fact, you know, the product revenue. But closely behind, just within a handful of percentage points, was the services revenue that they derive from your product, right? So it's a whole value proposition, and it's really important that when that's so high, that's in the top three, that as vendors you have really crisp professional services value propositions, and you make that part of your recruiting. Right, because these folks are, while the technology is important and the market share your technology has is important, you know, they want to know that they're signing up with a leadership offering, you know, that's prevalent in the marketplace. Without that piece of, and how am I going to generate services revenue? And oh, by the way, how are you going to help me reduce the cost of delivering that services revenue by training my people and sharing IP with me and all of those things? That has to be part of the overall value proposition, and that could be just as much of a reason as product revenue that someone chooses you over someone else. So, you know, make sure that there's time spent on understanding what the services value proposition is. And just lastly, here, we asked them kind of some broad questions around value of channel program innovations. One of the things that service partners struggle with is utilization, right? In another study, we found that utilization rates were running at about 55%, which is somewhat below industry average from what we've seen. So one of the number one asks is formal programs to become vendor professional services subcontractors, right? They're always looking for ways to maximize their bench utilization, even if it's not in projects that they're selling, it's places where you can utilize their services. Also high on their list was programs to match partners with others who have professional service capabilities, right? Either for additional bench strength or, some of your partners just don't want to invest, as heavily in this stuff. So matching was high on that list. And then some frustrations with the rules of engagement. The top answers largely were geared around account control and perception, right? These services heavy partners are unique in their ability and desire to really lead the engagement. Oftentimes they're brought in directly by the customer. Some of our data shows, without being brought in by a vendor or a partner and vendor deciding on a joint strategy to go after an account together. So it's really important to sensitize the field sales team that folks who've developed methodologies, folks who are really good at deployment, tend to also be really good upfront in selling and building trust and gaining influence over the client. I've been in many, many situations in my career where vendors have had field personnel who would just as soon push the services provider out until the bitter end. They want to close the deal. They want to close the deal at the end of the quarter. They want to lean the engagement. Understand, because that's how they're measured. But it's really an underutilization of a channel that's fully capable of leading, managing the customer relationship themselves, and delivering a high level of customer satisfaction to your vendors because they're capable of delivering the services in the back end. That's all the insight and data I had for today. I wanted to respect your time. There is more data, and there's four or five charts that I'll give to Lisa that she will send out to you with this presentation that I just didn't think we necessarily have time to get to, so you'll get that. If you're a Chainalytics subscriber, you can have access to this full data set, but you'll certainly get to the slides for today. Are there any questions, thoughts, comments, challenges, disagreements? We've got plenty of time if you want to spend some time on a Friday doing that. No?
No.
All right. Lisa?
Well, everyone, do keep in mind it is a lot of information to digest. So as always, as you have time to sort of think about what Jeff shared today, if you have time to review the materials that I'll send out and that will be stored on your portal, always know the door is always open. So if anything does come up or you have conversations about this content internally and you want to go through it with a little bit more detail, just reach out and we'll set up time and make sure we get any questions that come up answered for you.
Thanks, Jeff and Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, then. Well, off to you, your weekend. Have a great weekend, and thanks so much for being with us today. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, guys.